The official name of the facility was the Southeast Pathogen Identification Laboratory, though almost nobody called it that anymore. To hospitals, coroners, police departments, and occasionally federal agencies that prefer not to leave paper trails, we were simply the place that figured out bizarre blood. When something impossible turned up in a toxicology report, when a body arrived carrying symptoms that didn't belong in the state where it had been found, someone eventually called us. We were the people who looked at blood under a microscope and told everyone else what they were too uncomfortable to say out loud. The reputation started 3 years ago with a hunter found dead outside Asheville, North Carolina. He was 42 years old, healthy, experienced, and familiar with those woods. According to his family, he had walked the same trails for nearly 2 decades. When he failed to return home one evening, search teams began combing the forest. They found him the following morning beside a narrow creek, lying face up among the roots of a fallen tree. There were no signs of struggle, no indication that another person had been involved, and no obvious cause of death. The only unusual detail was the sheer number of bite marks scattered across his body, hundreds of them. Tiny punctures covered his neck, his arm, his face, even the skin beneath his clothing. The local authorities assumed insects. The medical examiner suspected a severe allergic reaction. Nobody thought much of it until the samples reached our lab. By the time we received the blood, the body had already begun to deteriorate, but the evidence remained. Under magnification, we discovered microscopic fragments lodged beneath the skin surrounding several of the wounds. The structures resembled mouthparts, though none of us recognized them immediately. Genetic sequencing eventually provided an answer that made everyone in the room question whether the machine had malfunctioned. The DNA belonged to a species of biting fly native to the Amazon rainforest. Not South America in general, not some broad tropical region. A specific insect whose known habitat existed thousands of miles away, deep within stretches of jungle that most people would never see in their lifetimes. We ran the test again and again and again, then a fourth time using equipment from another facility. Every result came back the same. Whatever had been that hunter had no business being anywhere near North Carolina. The scientific community spent months arguing about the findings. Some claimed the samples had been contaminated. Others suggested an error in sequencing. A few insisted the insect had somehow arrived accidentally through international shipping. The theories multiplied because the alternative was difficult to accept. The blood, however, remained stubbornly consistent. Whatever people want to believe, the evidence pointed toward a simple conclusion. A creature from the Amazon rainforest had fed on a man in the Appalachian Mountains. The second case arrived 6 months later and erased whatever comfort remained. A commercial fisherman was found dead aboard his vessel off the coast of Maine. His boat drifted into harbor during the early morning hours with no one at the wheel, eventually colliding with a dock hard enough to attract attention. Authorities boarded, expecting to find an accident victim. Instead, they discovered a man sprawled across the deck whose body appeared as though it had been attacked by something profoundly venomous. His skin was swollen and discolored. Large portions of his arms had darkened to shades of purple and black. The tissue around several wounds showed extensive necrosis despite the fact that he had likely been dead for less than a day. There was no evidence of chemical exposure, no indication of foul play, and no known marine life in the region capable of producing injuries that severe. The blood samples arrived at our facility 2 days later. I remember sitting in front of the toxicology screen as the results populated line by line. At first, I assumed the software had attached the wrong database profile. The toxin signature looks familiar, but not because it belonged to North America. I had seen it during a training seminar years earlier. It belonged to a species of highly venomous sea snake found in waters surrounding Indonesia and northern Australia. The venom attacked tissue aggressively while disrupting critical neurological functions, creating a cascade of symptoms that matched the victim perfectly. Once again, we reran the tests. Once again, we checked for contamination. Once again, every path led to the same impossible destination. A sea snake that should have been swimming near Australia had somehow left its signature in the bloodstream of a fisherman from Maine. After that, the cases became more frequent. Not frequent enough to make the evening news every week, but frequent enough that people in my profession noticed. A venomous spider from Southeast Asia identified in a death investigation outside Kansas City. A parasitic insect native to Central Africa, discovered in tissue samples from a rancher in New Mexico. Marine toxins appearing hundreds of miles inland. Tropical pathogens surfacing in places where winter temperatures should have killed them instantly. Each case was treated as an isolated anomaly. Each explanation sounded reasonable enough to survive public scrutiny. Yet viewed together, a pattern emerged that was becoming increasingly difficult to ignore. The creatures were moving. Not migrating in the traditional sense, not expanding their territories through the gradual process that scientists usually observed. This was something stranger. Species separated by oceans and continents seemed to be appearing in places where they had never existed before, as though invisible boundaries that had held for thousands of years were beginning to fail. Nobody could explain why, and my job wasn't to explain it anyway. I wasn't an ecologist, I wasn't a conservationist. I wasn't a politician looking for funding or a scientist looking for headlines. I was a blood specialist. People brought me samples and I told them what had happened. Understanding why it had happened belonged to someone else, which is how I preferred it. The call that changed my mind came on a Tuesday afternoon while I was halfway through lunch. My supervisor appeared in the doorway holding a satellite phone, his expression carrying that particular mixture of irritation and urgency that usually meant wealthy people were involved. "Pack a bag," he said. "You're heading to Nantucket." I lowered my sandwich. "What's in Nantucket?" He hesitated, and then he told me. "Jellyfish." I laughed. He didn't. An hour later, I was sitting aboard a helicopter cutting through a heavy gray cloud above the Atlantic Ocean. Our lab's main facility sat in the small town of Tifton, Georgia, meaning someone had spent a considerable amount of money to move us several states north on extremely short notice. Nobody offered much detail. All I knew was something had happened in the water near Nantucket, and that several influential people wanted answers soon. The pilot's headset crackled with static while I studied the case file resting on my lap. The photographs inside had been taken less than 12 hours earlier. The victim was a young boy. The first image showed him alive. Sunburned shoulders, sandy blonde hair. A smile that suggested summer vacation had been proceeding exactly as he hoped. The second image looked like someone else entirely. The skin along his torso was covered in long, whip-like lesions where tentacles had dragged across his whole body. Angry red welts twisted over his chest, stomach, and arms in grotesque patterns that resembled burns more than stings. In several areas, the tissue had already begun to blister. The swelling was severe enough that portions of his face appeared distorted, his eyelids nearly sealed shut from inflammation. Another photograph taken later in the emergency room showed patches of skin turning dark and mottled as blood vessels beneath the surface began to fail. I turned the page. The next image had been taken after cardiac arrest. There was a bluish discoloration around his lips. The muscles of the jaw appeared locked in a rigid expression of pain. Tiny ruptured blood vessels dotted the whites of his eyes. According to the attached notes, the victim had remained conscious long enough to describe feeling as though his entire body were being electrocuted from the inside. Minutes later, his heart became unstable. Shortly afterward, it stopped. I already knew what the blood would show before we landed. Box jellyfish venom is among the most potent toxins found anywhere on Earth. It attacks the cardiovascular system, the nervous system, and the skin simultaneously. Victims often describe pain so intense that coherent speech becomes impossible. In severe cases, the heart can fail before medical intervention has a chance to matter. The creatures responsible are typically associated with the waters near Australia and portions of Southeast Asia, places separated from Nantucket by entire oceans. Yet, as I stared at the photographs spread across my lap, I couldn't shake the feeling that I already knew what we were going to find. Because lately, the blood had been telling the same story over and over again. The medic bay had been assembled inside a converted ferry maintenance building overlooking the harbor. Temporary walls divided the structure into a maze of examination rooms, storage closets, and decontamination areas. Somewhere beyond the thin walls, generators hummed continuously, their vibration traveling through the concrete floor beneath my boots. A nurse handed me a disposable gown, gloves, protective sleeves, and a respirator. The amount of protective equipment was unnecessary for jellyfish venom. Everyone knew that. Yet fear has a way of creating extra layers. The more frightened people become, the more barriers they place between themselves and whatever scares them. The nurse finished adjusting the seal around my mask and pointed toward a metal door at the end of the corridor. "Three victims," she said quietly. "Divers." She left. I stood there for a moment. The walls rattled softly as wind pushed against the building outside. Through a narrow window, I could see the ocean beyond the harbor. Gray water, gray sky, gray horizon. It looked less like a landscape and more like a single endless surface stretching in every direction. I pushed through the door. The room beyond was small enough that it barely qualified as a morgue. Three stainless steel examination tables occupied most of the available space. White sheets covered the bodies. For a moment, I simply stared. I had seen hundreds of corpses. Thousands, if you count photographs. The dead eventually lose their ability to surprise you. These, however, did not. I approached the nearest table and folded back the sheet. The diver's skin looked as though someone had lashed him repeatedly with electrified wire. Hundreds of crimson welts, crosses, chest, neck, shoulders, and arms in tangled patterns. The injuries overlapped one another so densely that it was nearly impossible to identify where one sting ended and another began. Large sections of skin had swollen grotesquely, creating raised ridges beneath the surface. In some places, the tissue had begun to blister. In others, blood vessels had ruptured beneath the skin, leaving branching purple discolorations that resembled bruises spreading in real time. The second body was worse. The man's face had become unrecognizable beneath the swelling. His lips were split, his eyelids protruded. The skin around his throat displayed dark, rope-like lesions where tentacles had remained in contact long enough to deliver repeated doses of venom. Tiny patches of hemorrhaging spotted his cheeks and forehead. The third diver had likely survived the longest. You could tell from the damage. His hands were locked into rigid claws. The muscles had seized before death. His fingernails were broken, several torn nearly free. Whether he'd been clawing at his own skin or attempting to remove tentacles, I couldn't say. Across his abdomen ran dozens of overlapping sting patterns that looked almost decorative from a distance, like vines, roots, flowers. That thought lingered unpleasantly. Bloom. That was the term marine biologists used when jellyfish populations exploded. Bloom. The word always sounded absurd to me. A bloom should be something beautiful. Spring flowers spreading across a hillside. Cherry blossoms opening after winter. Color, warmth, life. Yet in marine science, a bloom could mean millions of translucent predators multiplying until entire stretches of ocean became hazardous. The word remained the same while the meaning inverted completely. A field of roses was a bloom. A swarm of venomous jellyfish, capable of stopping human hearts, was also a bloom. Language had a cruel sense of humor sometimes. I moved to the far wall and began organizing sample kits. The room remained silent except for the occasional buzz of lights overhead. Outside, distant footsteps echoed through the corridor. I was labeling collection tubes when the door opened behind me. An older man stepped inside. He looked to be in his late 60s, perhaps older. Windburned skin, gray hair, wire-framed glasses. The kind of face that had spent decades outdoors studying things most people never even noticed. A laminated ID badge swung from his neck. Marine Ecology Task Force. Interesting. One of the people trying to answer the question that came after mine. Why? The man removed his glasses and wiped them against his sleeve. His hands shook noticeably. "You are the blood specialist?" "That's me." He nodded repeatedly. Too many times. His eyes shifted toward the body before looking away again. For several seconds, he seemed unable to speak. "Have you..." His fingers tightened around his glasses. "Have you ever seen anything like this?" Every word trembled. I looked back toward the examination tables. 3 dead divers, 1 dead boy. The growing number of hospitalizations. An island increasingly surrounded by venomous animals that should have been half a world away. "No," I told him. "I'd never seen anything like this." The answer visibly affected him. His shoulders slumped. "But," I continued, "that doesn't mean we should jump straight to the worst conclusions." The older man laughed. It wasn't a pleasant sound. It sounded exhausted, scared. "The worst conclusion already happened." "What do you mean by that?" He walked toward the small window overlooking the harbor. For several seconds, he simply stared at the water until finally he spoke again. "The surveys came back this morning. We thought we were tracking a localized group, maybe a few dozen individuals, a temporary incursion, something we could monitor. We were wrong." I set down the sample container. "How wrong were you?" He stared through the glass. "When the divers went down yesterday, they weren't surveying a bloom." His reflection looked pale against the window. "They were inside one." A chill traveled through me. "How many?" He turned. The expression on his face was unlike anything I'd seen from a scientist before. "We don't know." The answer hung in the room. And then he added, "Because we can't see the edges. People hear jellyfish and imagine individual animals. But that's not how this works. A bloom is not a herd. It is not a school of fish. It is a living cloud. Millions of drifting organisms spread through three-dimensional space. Surface currents move them. Deep currents move them. Wind moves them. Tides move them." His trembling had returned. "If there are enough of them, closing beaches won't matter. Closing harbors won't matter." I felt my stomach tighten. "What about eradication?" Another exhausted laugh. "How?" The question wasn't meant to be rhetorical. It was genuine. "How?" "Poisons would devastate everything else in the ecosystem. Nets are useless. Boats would spend months collecting fragments. And even then you'd still miss thousands, maybe more." He looked again toward the bodies. "Maybe millions." Neither of us spoke then. Outside, a foghorn groaned somewhere across the water. The scientist stared toward the harbor as though expecting something to emerge from the gray horizon. When he spoke again, his voice was barely above a whisper. "Box jellyfish aren't supposed to survive here." I nodded and said that I knew. "They aren't supposed to be able to reproduce here either." The scientist's eyes met mine, and for the first time since entering the room, they were completely steady. "Which means if the numbers we are seeing are real..." He stopped, his jaw tightened. Neither of us wanted to finish the sentence, because there was only one ending. The jellyfish were not visiting Nantucket. They belonged here now. "If all of this is a jellyfish problem, why am I here?" The scientist looked away from the harbor. "I deal with blood, venom, toxicology. Determining what killed someone after everyone else has failed. I don't study marine ecosystems. I can't tell you why box jellyfish are showing up in Nantucket." "No," he agreed quietly. "But you may be able to tell us why someone survived them." The scientist reached beneath his arm and removed a thin folder. Inside was a photograph of a man sitting in a canoe. He looked to be somewhere around 30 years old. Lean, athletic, ordinary. The kind of face you would forget 5 minutes after meeting him. His name is Peter Mercer, the scientist said. Yesterday morning, he was paddling through one of the tidal channels east of the island. There was a film crew nearby shooting recreational footage. They captured what occurred. I studied the image in question. What happened? Peter lowered his hand into the water, directly into the bloom. Are you positive? The footage is crystal clear. One of the animals wraps around his arm. The tentacles remain in contact for several seconds. A confirmed box jellyfish sting? Yes. Well, then he should be dead. That's what everyone keeps saying. Which is why you're here. The quarantine wing occupied a section of the facility that appeared to have been assembled in a matter of days. Temporary containment walls divided the corridor into a series of isolated chambers connected by thin plastic barriers and sealed doors. Air filtration units roared overhead, every precaution suggested an infectious disease outbreak rather than a jellyfish. As I approached the final room, I noticed the guards. There were four of them positioned throughout the corridor. Not security guards, not police officers. These men possessed a different kind of stillness. They wore dark suits despite the heat, communicated almost entirely through brief glances, and watched every movement with the detached focus of people trained to anticipate problems before they had happened. One of them opened the final door without speaking. Inside sat Peter Mercer. At first glance, he looked surprisingly normal. That impression lasted only a few seconds. The obvious injuries from the sting were still present. Red lesions climbed his arms and crossed portions of his neck. Faded welts remained visible beneath his hospital gown. Yet those injuries were not what held my attention. Something else was happening. The skin along his forearms possessed an unusual texture. Beneath the light, certain areas reflected light differently than normal skin. Small geometric patches interrupted the natural pattern of pores and hair follicles. They weren't scales, at least not yet. They resembled dense layers of tissue emerging from below the surface, as though the architecture of his skin had begun reorganizing itself. His eyes unsettled me even more. Nothing about their color appeared unusual. The problem was the way they moved. People blink instinctively. Effortlessly. Peter seemed to blink in stages. One eyelid would begin closing a fraction of a second before the other. The movement was subtle enough that most people would never even notice it. Unfortunately, once I noticed it, I couldn't stop noticing. His monitors displayed remarkably stable vital signs. More than stable, actually. I reviewed the readings twice before trusting them. His oxygen saturation levels bordered on impossible. The numbers looked less like a patient recovering from severe venom and more like someone receiving concentrated oxygen therapy. Peter looked up from the bed. You the blood guy? His voice sounded normal. Maybe that's what made everything worse. Yep, that's me. Peter nodded. They've taken enough blood from me to fill a swimming pool. A weak smile across his face. There was an alertness in his eyes that hadn't appeared in the photographs. Something watchful. The door opened behind me, and one of the suited men entered. Outside. His tone suggested there was no alternative, so I followed him into the hallway. Up close, he looked exactly like the sort of person who would never identify himself. Clean haircut, expressionless face, expensive suit. The human equivalent of a locked filing cabinet. What agency are you with? I asked him. He ignored the question. To him, I was barely more than a prop. What matters is that Mr. Mercer experienced a documented box jellyfish venom event. Multiple witnesses observed it. It was captured on camera. The animal responsible has been recovered. And yet Mr. Mercer is still alive, and we need to understand why. That's what I'm here for. No, he replied. You're here because you're the best person available. The distinction was subtle. His eyes drifted toward the observation window. The information remains here. The samples remain here. The patient remains here. So does the story. If you need equipment, you will get it. If you need personnel, you will get it. For the next 48 hours, your only responsibility is Peter Mercer. Find out why he is still alive. The next 2 days vanish into a blur of blood samples, sequencing reports, tissue analysis, and increasingly disturbing questions. The facility possessed equipment that had no business existing on a temporary island laboratory. Someone had moved tens of millions of dollars worth of technology into Nantucket almost overnight. Every machine I requested appeared within hours. The urgency surrounding Peter Mercer bordered on obsession. I reviewed footage of the sting repeatedly. The video left little room for debate. Peter had lowered his hand into the water while paddling. Moments later, tentacles emerged from beneath the surface and wrapped around his forearm. The contact lasted several horrifying seconds before he recoiled. Everything that followed should have killed him. The toxin markers were present. The tissue damage was present. The cardiovascular stress was present. Yet the expected progression never occurred. Instead of collapsing, Peter stabilized. Instead of dying, he adapted. That word bothered me every time it entered my thoughts. Adaptation was something species accomplish across generations. Peter seemed to be accomplishing it over hours. The first abnormalities appeared in his blood chemistry. Proteins emerged that shouldn't have existed. Entire cellular pathways activated without explanation. Gene expression patterns began shifting so rapidly that consecutive samples looked like they belonged to different people. The deeper I dug, the stranger the results became. His red blood cells became remarkably efficient at oxygen transport. Microscopic examination revealed subtle structural alterations within several cell populations. Nerve tissue appeared unusually resistant to toxic interference. Organs that should have been struggling after severe venom instead displayed improved performance. It was as though Peter's body had examined the venom, identified the threat, and begun rewriting itself in response. On the second evening, the physical changes became impossible to ignore. A nurse called me shortly after midnight. By the time I reached Peter's room, 6 staff members had already gathered outside. Nobody spoke. They simply stared through the glass. I joined them. For several seconds, I wasn't entirely sure what I was seeing. The skin along both sides of Peter's neck had developed a series of vertical folds. At first glance, they resembled deep wrinkles caused by swelling. Closer examination revealed something else entirely. The structures possessed remarkable symmetry. Thin layers of tissue folded inward beneath the jawline, creating organized channels extending toward the throat. When Peter inhaled, the folds moved. The motion reminded me of something evolutionary, something unfinished, as though his body had begun constructing an organ before deciding whether to complete it. The changes accelerated throughout the night. The skin across his forearms thickened noticeably. The strange reflective patches expanded. Under magnification, the tissue no longer resembled ordinary human skin. It appeared denser, more layered. Tiny overlapping structures developed beneath the surface, creating patterns disturbingly reminiscent of scales emerging from beneath translucent flesh. His fingertips flattened. The spaces between several fingers stretched slightly. Not enough to qualify as webbing, but enough to suggest the possibility. Most disturbing of all were Peter's eyes. By dawn, the pupils no longer responded together. One would dilate while the other remained narrow. One would contract while the other expanded. The movement seemed independent, as though two different systems were competing for control. Peter himself appeared increasingly calm. That frightened me more than the physical alterations. Patients experiencing catastrophic physiological changes are usually terrified. Peter, however, seemed fascinated, curious, almost comforted. By the end of the second day, he could identify conversations occurring through multiple sealed doors. He accurately described equipment operating somewhere else in the building. His hearing had become extraordinarily sensitive. His cardiovascular performance continued improving despite every principle of medicine, insisting the opposite should be happening. Then came the moment I can still see whenever I close my eyes. Later that evening, I had entered Peter's room alone. The lights were dim. Outside, darkness covered the harbor. Peter sat upright in bed before staring out the window. For several moments, he didn't acknowledge my presence, and then he spoke.
"Do you hear it?"
I listened. Wind, generators, distant waves. Peter smiled faintly. His eyes remained fixed on the darkness beyond the glass. For the first time, he turned towards me. The room's pale light reflected strangely across the altered skin along his face and neck. His expression looked neither frightened nor confused. It looked familiar, as though he had remembered something he had once known a very long time ago. Peter spoke.
"They're calling for me."
The words settled over the room like a physical weight. Before I could respond, something beneath the skin of his throat shifted. At first, I assumed it was another involuntary muscle contraction. Over the previous 48 hours, I had witnessed countless abnormalities. Yet this movement was different. It traveled beneath the flesh with a purpose, like a ripple passing through water. The tissue along both sides of his neck bulged outward before settling again. A second later, it happened once more, only stronger. Peter closed his eyes. His breathing deepened. The cardiac monitors beside his bed immediately responded, alarms beginning to chirp as his physiology veered further away from anything resembling a normal human parameter. Then the real changes began. His entire body arched against the mattress. Bones shifted beneath the skin with audible force. The sound reminded me of branches twisting during a storm. His jaw opened wider than anatomy should have permitted, forcing the ligaments surrounding it into grotesque new positions. I watched tendons slide beneath translucent skin while the structure of his face slowly reorganized itself. What frightened me most was the deliberate nature of the process. This wasn't tissue failing. It wasn't disease consuming a host. Peter's body appeared to be following instructions. The fold along his neck suddenly expanded, separating into layered structures that opened and closed rhythmically. Thin crimson membranes unfolded from within, exposing delicate tissues that fluttered rapidly as they interacted with the surrounding air. They resembled gills at first glance, though larger and more intricate than anything found in nature. His skin continued changing beneath my eyes. The reflective patches spread outward from his arms and neck, merging into broad regions of overlapping armored tissue. A clear mucus-like secretion coated portions of his body, catching the fluorescent light and giving him the appearance of something recently hauled from the depths of the sea. The smell arrived moments later. Salt water, seaweed, wet stone. The scent of tide pools exposed during low tide mixed with something older and far more unpleasant. His fingers lengthened slightly, the joints became more pronounced. The nails detached and fell onto the bedsheets, replaced by darker structures emerging beneath them. They looked stronger, sharper, better suited for some purpose I couldn't begin to understand. The changes continued for several minutes. I found myself unable to move. Every rational explanation I possessed had abandoned me long ago. Nothing in medicine prepared a person for watching a human body systematically rewrite itself. Every scientific framework I'd relied upon collapsed under the weight of what I was witnessing. And then, almost as suddenly as it had begun, the transformation stopped. The room became quiet. Peter sat motionless upon the bed. The monitors continued their frantic beeping, but he no longer appeared distressed. In fact, he looked peaceful. That was perhaps the most disturbing thing of all. The suffering had vanished. The panic was gone. Whatever process had been unfolding seemed to have reached its destination. Slowly, he lifted his head and looked at me. The face that had met my gaze still contained traces of the man from the canoe. I could recognize the structure of his features. I could recognize fragments of his expression. Yet those familiar details now existed along something profoundly alien. Looking at him felt like looking at a photograph that had been submerged underwater for years. The original image remained visible, but something else had grown over it. When he spoke again, the sound no longer seemed entirely human. The altered structures along his throat vibrated with each word. Additional tones accompanied his voice, creating strange harmonics beneath the language itself. The result sounded as though multiple voices were speaking from the same mouth. The plea was soft, almost gentle. His enormous eyes remained fixed on my own.
Please.
For the first time since entering the room, I realized that Peter Mercer might still be trapped somewhere inside whatever had happened to him. His altered hands gripped the rails of the bed. The membranes along his neck fluttered rapidly.
Let me swim with my family.
The room fell silent. I wish I could say the request sounded insane. I wish I could say I dismissed it immediately. The truth is far less comforting. For one terrible moment, I considered it. Over the previous 2 days, I had watched doctors fail to help him. I had watched science fail to explain him. Every treatment had accomplished nothing. Every test had produced impossible answers. Part of me wondered whether the ocean truly was what he needed, whether returning him to the water might somehow reverse what was happening, whether the thing before me was not mutating but adapting. The thought horrified me, yet it remained. I found myself rising from my chair, and my hand moved instinctively towards the restraints attached to the bed. And that was when the gunshots came. The explosions were deafening inside the confined room. Two rapid blasts shattered the silence and transformed the world into chaos. For an instant, I couldn't comprehend what I was seeing. And then reality caught up. The wall behind Peter's bed had been painted with blood. Fragments of bones struck the far partition. Shreds of tissue slid down the white surfaces. Among the remains were structures that did not belong inside any human body I had ever studied. Pale, translucent organs lay scattered across the mattress. Thin, branching tissues resembling coral protruded from torn flesh. Membranes and sacs unlike anything in medical literature hung from ruined sections of anatomy. The transformation had ended permanently. Standing in the doorway was the suited man. The pistol remained steady in his hands. Smoke drifted lazily from the barrel. For several seconds, neither of us spoke. The alarms continued to scream. Blood continued to drip from the wall. The suited man simply stared at what remained of Peter Mercer. Then he lowered his weapon. His expression never changed. He looked at me and said, "You can go now." Several hours later, I sat aboard a helicopter headed toward the mainland. Nobody attempted to debrief me. Nobody asked what I had learned. Nobody requested my findings. It was as though the entire incident had already been classified, buried, and forgotten before I had even left the island. Below us, Nantucket gradually disappeared into the morning haze. I spent most of the flight staring out the window. At first, I thought the exhaustion was playing tricks on me. The ocean below appeared strangely pale in certain locations. Vast stretches of water possessed a lighter coloration than the surrounding Atlantic, creating irregular patterns that extended toward the horizon. They looked almost like clouds drifting beneath the surface. The farther we traveled, the more of them I noticed. Hundreds, perhaps thousands. Long, pale formations moving silently through the water. I pressed closer to the glass. The patches weren't stationary. They were moving. As the mainland finally emerged in the distance, I found myself remembering Peter's final words. The helicopter continued westward, and I realized what disturbed me most. Peter had never asked to return to the ocean. He had asked to return to his family. And judging by the colors spreading through the Atlantic beneath us, I feared that Peter's family was far larger than any of us could have imagined.